Hi, this is Helena. Before we get to the episode, I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge what happened because I'm having a hard time thinking about much else. On Friday, June 24th, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. I'm not sure how you feel about it, but the past few days I've been feeling really helpless. But I know I'm not helpless. None of us are. There are resources that can help us figure out what we want to do. So let me give you a website that I found helpful. It's choice.crd.co. So that's choice.crd.co. I hope it helps. All right, now here's the episode. This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, yelling down the phone. Nina Mingya Powles lives in London, near a women-only natural swimming pond. The pond is ringed with willows and reeds, and in the summer, flowers. But she swims there in winter, too. The water is so cold, then you have to get in quickly or you change your mind. And when the cold hits you, it pushes the air out of your lungs. Then you go numb, and only after that, the pain begins in your fingers and toes before it travels. At some point, Powles asks the lifeguard, "How do you know when to get out?" The lifeguard answers, "When you start to feel wonderful, euphoria is hypothermia." Nina Mingya Powles seems to engage her entire body no matter what she does, whether it's swimming, sewing clothes, making zines, cooking, eating, and even writing, because to her, language and playing with language is no less physical than dipping your body into ice-cold water. I recently sat down to talk with her about her poetry collection, Magnolia, and her book of essays titled Small Bodies of Water. Here's our conversation. What kind of morning were you having?
I had a lovely morning, actually. A friend and I went for a swim, which was really beautiful. There's a natural swimming pond nearby, the very same one in the book. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we went there this morning, which was really beautiful. It's really hot as well.
Oh, that's amazing. A natural pond. Although, are there a lot of weedy things that are kind of licking your feet and making you think that it's like a fish?
No, there aren't actually, because it's really deep, so you can't feel anything like around the bottom, which is good. But around the edges, yeah, there's like lots of irises and lilies and bulrushes and things.
That sounds amazing. Well, I wanted to ask you if you can say where you're from, where you've lived, like how old you were. Is that something that you have in mind?
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, I was born in Aotearoa, New Zealand, in Wellington. But then when I was three, we moved to New York and lived there for 4 years. And then we went back to New Zealand and had another 4 or 5 years there. And then when I was 11, we moved to Shanghai and spent 3 years there and then back to New Zealand again. But now I live in London, which is kind of an unexpected place that I've ended up.
Right. And then your mother is from Malaysia, right? Like she was born in Malaysia, I think.
Exactly. My mum's Malaysian Chinese and she was born in Kota Kinabalu in Borneo, which is a beautiful city. So yeah, so I have family there and that's another place I keep going back to and keep writing about.
And you talk a lot about Hakka in your book, which is your mother's native tongue, right?
Yeah, I think she grew up with a whole mix of English and Hakka and also Cantonese in her house. But then, yeah, Hakka is like the language that's always being like yelled down the phone or across the kitchen, like whenever I'm with my mum's family. Yeah. So that is their very much like the language of the home. Yeah, not a language that I'm at all fluent in, though. It's like very familiar to me, but it's not a language I can speak, sadly.
And is it at all related to Cantonese or Mandarin Chinese? Like if you know it, you can recognize certain words or...
I think so. It's very closely related, particularly to Cantonese. So it sounds quite similar to me, like as someone who doesn't speak Cantonese or Hakka. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you went to China after college, right? Or when was this?
Exactly. Yeah. So I graduated from uni in Wellington. I did a degree in English literature. And I just finished my creative writing master's, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with that, if anything. So it was a good thing to do, was to go and do 18 months of intensive full-time Mandarin language study.
Oh, it was Mandarin. See, yeah. That, I find that so interesting that you decided to study Mandarin, which is like two steps removed almost from your mother's mother tongue. Why did you choose to do Mandarin?
It's almost like it wasn't so much a choice, because Mandarin is what was available to me and is what is widely available in terms of resources and teachers and courses and university classes. So it was offered as a major at my uni, whereas Cantonese very rarely is.
Yeah.
And then certainly not Hakka, which Hakka doesn't even have its own written script.
Oh, wow.
And my mum also does speak Mandarin, and so do her family members. So it's like part of the ecosystem of languages, like English is as well for my family.
Uh-huh.
But now I'm wishing that I could spend more time doing Hakka, kind of doing this like little YouTube tutorials and that kind of thing. But it's quite hard to find like, you know, a Hakka class.
Yes.
I haven't yet found one.
Yeah, so, of course. Yeah. And so when you started studying Chinese, like I hear that a lot from people who want to learn later in life the language of their parents or their ancestors. You know, you often hear that they are a little frustrated because even though they know that rationally they don't have an advantage, you know, over other, let's say, English speakers, it still feels somehow that that is your birthright, that you should be good at this, whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. Is that something that you felt?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's lots of shame and embarrassment tied up with this process of language learning, particularly when you meet a whole lot of other people learning this language, some of whom have those heritage connections and then some don't. Some are just like really interested in Asian languages or they want to have a career in China. So that was really interesting and prompted a lot of writing, actually, a lot of poems, I think, on this subject of like ownership and belonging and how we might feel we can't really claim a language or can't claim belonging because of not having access to the language. And I just think I've gradually accepted that it's literally a lifelong process, is this language learning, and it's not linear in any way, shape or form, but they do teach it to you that way, which you're meant to kind of progress in this step by step, and gradually you attain fluency. But yeah, I think for me it's just always going to be slow, and there's loops and different different tracks and different ways of engaging with the language apart from like textbook or memorization. So sometimes it's writing poetry or cooking or walking or swimming or gardening. Like all these things to me are connected.
Wait, can you talk about that a little bit? Like how are they connected to language learning?
I think what I mean is that these ways of being in the world, they're just all a part of me. Like for myself, I would say, or definitely used to say, I'm a writer and a poet, but over the past 2.5 years, it hasn't necessarily always been easy to write at all or even read at all. And so I think I have been working on expanding my creative practice to include these other more physical ways of creating, like cooking, or like during the pandemic, I taught myself how to sew.
Mm-hmm.
And so these things are now in my head becoming very embedded in how I express, I don't know, questions that I'm obsessed with or subjects I'm interested in or languages I'm trying to learn. So yeah, it's not a good explanation, but working on it.
It's interesting, especially because I feel like, you know, as you said, cooking, sewing, gardening, they are very bodily, right? Yeah. Like you do them with movement, basically.
Yeah.
But I also feel like, especially when you're first learning a language, a lot of it is just trying to shape your mouth in this new shape, right? Like just trying to wrestle against your instincts that come from your mother tongue and sort of be like, wait, can my mouth make this new sound, you know? How did that go for you?
Yes. I love speaking about this because it is so interesting, the physical aspect of language acquisition. So for me, though, I think I'm very lucky in that I did grow up with these traces of languages around me. Again, it was probably mostly more Hakka and Cantonese, but occasionally Mandarin as well. And then, of course, as a young teenager, I was living in China. So, and I did do some like basic Mandarin lessons at that time when I was probably like 13, which is quite a, like an influential period. Mm-hmm. And so I think in terms of like how my tongue and my mouth moves around the syllables, I actually, that is actually was really natural for me. Like the tones, the sounds of the consonants, which are quite different from English. But I do remember that when I later, when I was in Shanghai, when I was like 21, I had a German friend, and she, her Mandarin's really great, but we'd mostly be talking in English. And once she said to me like, oh, my mouth gets so tired when I speak English.
When she speaks English?
Yeah, when she speaks English. But we were gradually getting less tired in our, like in our mouth and tongue muscles when we were speaking Mandarin, which is like a slow sign that we're getting used to it, right? But I loved that insight from her about English, which I think about all the time.
Yeah, right. Because for you, probably you never get tired of that because that's where you grew up speaking. I was wondering if we can go to a poem. So it's a poem from your book, Magnolia, and it's on page 55, and it is called Mother Tongue.
Yeah, absolutely.
But because the poem is printed in two columns, and the subtitle of the poem is A Poem in Two Voices, each column is sort of like a ghost presence for the other column. And so I was wondering if you can read it once, just normal, and then if you can whisper the whole poem so that I can edit them over one another. Maybe it's going to be stupid. Maybe it's not going to work, but I want to try it, you know?
Yeah, I would love to. This one is a really interesting one to try to read aloud. And I rarely read it aloud for that reason, that it's it can be read in different ways.
Yeah.
Just before I read the poem, I'll mention that this poem is very much about Pawpaw, my grandmother, who I didn't know that well, but I would visit her quite often as a child, but we didn't share a language because she only spoke very little English and I didn't really speak Hakka. So our communication was very much sporadic and quite often over food because she was a great cook. So this really is a poem for her.
Mother tongue,
Mu Yu, a poem in two voices.
What if my mother never left this place, where the heat pours down between the coconut palms?
I wake to the sound of blue mosque morning prayers. I have never known what the words mean, but I can hear the ache in the kitchen every morning. I peel jackfruit with my fingers while they talk over and around me, in a language so familiar but so far away. In the kitchen, every night, I eat pink rice cakes with my hands. The powdered sugar sticks to my lips. And Pawpaw says, "Is it good?" "Yes, it is good," I reply in Hakka, because it is all I can say. And we sit there with the quiet burning of the mosquito coils. She hands me a paper napkin. She gestures towards her mouth. She touches my hand without speaking.
I wake to the sound of blue mosque morning prayers.
What if my mother never left this place, where the heat pours down between the coconut palms? If I had grown up here, I would have different colored hair and different colored eyes. I would speak to Pawpaw all the time. We would chop vegetables together and peel the shells off quail eggs. On blue evenings, we would sit looking out for distant lightning above the hills where plastic flowers fall against colored graves. See how it lights up her face as the rain cools off the surface of my skin.
She hands me a paper
of this dream where I am not trapped in any language.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm so interested in that very last line, you know, this dream where I'm not trapped in any language. Do you feel right now that you're trapped, or when your grandmother was alive, that you felt trapped in English?
I think so. I think I, to varying degrees, often feel that way with English, and often have this feeling of wanting to kind of break free of English and be able to have that flexibility in language and to kind of dream in another language, which I don't think is an experience I've ever had yet that I know of. But I think it is in poetry where I feel like that entrapment no longer really exists, or there's a kind of a third space, a in-between space between those languages, which is very rich.
Yeah, because in this book also there are a lot of Chinese characters sort of sprinkled through the text, and sometimes you explain what the words mean and sometimes you don't. Why did you decide to do it like that?
Yeah, I started out kind of adding Chinese characters in the poems because at the time I was really immersed in, like, well, and it was called full immersion Chinese classes. And so at the same time, I was like each afternoon doing my Chinese homework, which is like writing one character 15 times to get the muscle memory in my fingers, like writing the strokes.
Yeah.
Which was really hard and really and quite exhausting. So I guess in a poem, it was another way of engaging with a character and pulling it apart and putting it back together again and making the process a bit more playful, and also as a kind of outlet for the frustration of when you're learning a language and it feels like you can only keep a certain amount in your head at one time, but at any moment, like, you'll forget everything, or something you learned last week will just disappear, but other words stay and other words just like disappear.
Yeah.
So I was always feeling that unsteady ground of like near fluency, but it, not quite. So I think that's what led me to use the characters in the poems. Mm-hmm. And I think other poets have taught me a lot about being bold in not using a glossary or not translating and decentering English.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I feel really lucky to have come across, particularly in a poet, Mary Jean Chan, who does something kind of similar and deliberately decides not to translate. And she, I remember she made me think about, like, who are we writing for? Like, could we just write for ourselves or a friend or a family member, and, you know, do we need to be thinking about translating ourselves? So that was a real kind of breakthrough moment for me.
It's interesting. I mean, I had a digital copy of your book, so that made it easier in that respect, but I found it really fun actually to copy paste the characters that I didn't know what they meant, or even the ones that you did translate, but I was like, okay, still, I want to know more about them. So to copy paste them in Google and then hit image search, you know, just like show me the images of what this is. And it was so nice because it introduces this whole, this layer of ambiguity also, you know, in the text where I'm like, ah, maybe I understand what this means. There are a lot of different pictures. Like there was one character. God, what did it mean? It, every picture of it that I saw was two rainbows. And I thought, what the hell is two rainbows? Like, what is the word here?
Like a double rainbow.
And then I actually looked it up in a dictionary, and it was something like secondary rainbow, which I didn't know was a thing, you know, but like sometimes a rainbow, like there are two. One is like very clear, and the other was sort of faint. Can't remember what poem that was. But I liked that layer, you know?
Yeah, that's very cool. Like a way that internet translation maybe can actually be really rich and
yes.
and fun.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you talked about like sort of the dominance of English, you know, and that you didn't want to cater to or emphasize even more like sort of that dominance by adding a glossary or translating these words. And I wonder how, because you are the product of colonization, so you are the product of that kind of domination of English mm-hmm. in so many countries in the world, you know, from, God, I keep forgetting the word, Aotearoa, New Zealand, to mm-hmm. Malaysia. I mean, the fact that people speak English in both those countries is like a direct mm-hmm. result of colonialism. Yeah.
Yes.
And how has your attitude to English changed as you've become more aware of that? Like, are you angry at English? Are there words that you've really started to loathe in English and that you wish you could just smuggle in from one of the other languages that you've you've learned, you know?
That's a great question. I think that over time, it's really that I have become aware of my English, like in a way that you do not start out that way, perhaps when you're growing up in a majority English speaking country, mm-hmm. a former British colony. You do not necessarily question your English, but then I feel so grateful because I think being a teenager in Aotearoa and then later going to university there and frequently visiting now as an adult, there's so much more Māori language being spoken in a public, very much public sense. And now it is so much stronger, the sense of it being a multilingual country. I mean, Māori has been an official language of New Zealand for quite some time, I believe, but that's really only more recently become more mainstream. And there's still many issues with it, and there's still barriers to accessing Māori language education, particularly for Māori youth. But I feel like this has really given me a really valuable perspective and one that I'm always learning more about. And I think you mentioned any words. I mean, I'm sure there are English words I loathe, but but then again, English is how I have, it's the lens through which I live and see everything and breathe. And it's also what has let kind of it's through which I've accessed literature and poetry, which is amazing. And, you know, my favorite poets write in English primarily. So I think it's about like shifting English slightly off center and thinking about the ways someone like me, like English is still, that's my main language, but there are other languages that are inside my body in other ways and that are a part of me. But there is a really important Māori word, which I've written a little bit about and is not super easy to translate into English, but so it's tō iwi, and it kind of means guest people or immigrant, guest person. And in the context of Aotearoa, it's used to describe kind of more recent immigrants as well as European colonizers. So it's a very broad term, but it's a valuable one for me thinking about my role as a person from New Zealand and what it means to grow up living on Indigenous land and how it kind of pairs, to me, that word pairs with haka, which kurdia is the word for haka in Mandarin, and that also means guest people.
What a crazy coincidence.
Yeah, because the haka people were like a migratory group that have kind of moved south over the centuries from kind of northern or the kind of middle part of China southwards. And then there's so many diasporic groups of different types of haka languages and haka peoples now. So that really, that really chimes with me. And now also someone who lives in a place where I'm not from here, but kind of making a home here. Yeah, it's all connected.
also on page 39 of your essay collection, Small Bodies of Water, there's an excerpt that starts with in the gift shop.
Oh, yeah.
And before you start, can you introduce it somehow? Anything you want to say about it?
Yeah, of course. Not long after I moved to London, I began spotting this tree around the city. And it's a tree that has bright yellow bell-shaped flowers. And this was so bizarre to me. And I was quite shocked when I first saw one of these trees, because they're native to New Zealand and they're kind of New Zealand's national tree. And I had never in any context seen this tree outside of New Zealand, and it was just the most bizarre thing to see it blooming also at a different month of the year, because in New Zealand they bloom in spring, which is September, and it's opposite here. So I ended up writing this essay about this tree because I became very obsessed with its appearance here in the city, and it felt like kind of apparitions sometimes. And I looked into the history of how the tree got to the UK.
Right.
So, yeah. In the gift shop of the Royal Academy of Arts in London, I find an enormous book with glossy illustrations. Joseph Banks Florilegium, Botanical Treasures from Cook's Voyage. I flip to the index, scanning for K, Corphi. It's not there, but I flip through the pages looking for yellow. It has been indexed under its other name, Sophora tetraptera, four-winged fruit. Corphi seeds were first brought to England from Aotearoa by the botanist Sir Joseph Banks on James Cook's first voyage in 1769. The historian W.R.B. Oliver notes that Banks collected more than 60 plant specimens, including Corphi, at the very place where Cook and his crew first set foot in Aotearoa, at Turanganui Akiwa, Poverty Bay, on the east coast. Their landing was not a peaceful one. 9 Māori people were shot dead by the crew of the Endeavour, including Te Māro, a leader of the Ngāti Oneone people. Drawing from the crew's diaries, Joseph Angus Mackie records that after examining the bodies of the dead, the botanists collected flowers. In 1774, the seeds collected by Banks were planted at Chelsea Physic Garden in London, then known as the Apothecary's Garden.
Thank you. It's such a gutting piece. I mean, especially because you write it so dryly. The way that you just line up the sequence of events, you know, first shot 9 Maori people, mm-hmm. and then just collected some specimens, you know, just some flowers. I'd never really put so much thought to the violent history behind, you know, this very innocuous seeming activity of just going to a place and collecting some flowers because you're interested in like the beautiful things that grow there, you know. Was that something that you had thought about before you started really diving into this history?
It's not something I know a lot about, and I'm still in no way an expert, but I think moving to the UK and realizing the different relationships that people here have with colonial histories, and how in many respects, a lot of colonial history is not widely known by, you know, British people, not necessarily taught in schools. And also this essay came about at a time when I was becoming really interested in gardening and plants. And, you know, this is totally just a hobby of mine, and I don't know a lot about different species, but just thinking about like where these plants have come from, the idea of what does it mean to be native or non-native or invasive. And I think writers like particularly Jessica J. Lee, who's a brilliant environmental historian and writer, and she writes a lot about plants and botany and colonization and empire. So these things really are inseparable.
I was
gradually realizing. And so I think this essay is kind of the culmination of these feelings.
Yeah. And at the beginning of the essay, you also write, again, it's such a like almost throwaway line, but it hit me so hard. You know, you're scanning that book, this Florilegium, you know, treasures from Cook's voyage. You know, you're scanning that and trying to look for a kophi, this yellow tree that you grew up with. But it's not there under the K. It has been indexed under its other name, you write. Yes. Sophora tetraptera. So it's like a Latin name, you know. And I was wondering if you can tell me about when you think of that tree, you imagine that tree, and you call it by its Maori name. Mm-hmm. What does that evoke that reading that Latin name does not? Or what different emotions come up when you read the Latin name?
Yeah, it's like as if some kind of mistranslation had occurred, because in New Zealand, the tree is very commonly called the kowhai, and it's one of those Māori words which has for a long time, you know, since I was very young, maybe before, been a part of, you know, regular vocabulary that you grow up with, along with names for birds and other trees and place names. So I really like that it's part of the fabric of a multilingual, multicultural place that I come from. And then to read this Latin name, yeah, that was quite strange. And I also came across in a gardening magazine, because my mother-in-law, who's an amazing gardener, bought me this gardening magazine subscription. So I love looking at them and learning about plants through her as well. But I came across a spread of photographs of a kowhai, and my reaction, like on seeing that and like sitting in my kind of my living room here in London, is really like bodily, like I gasped and kind of froze, like, oh my god, because it's kind of displaced, like suddenly it's in this gardening magazine. And I was like reading the caption of the pictures, and it doesn't say kowhai anywhere. I think it said Sophora tetraptera, and an English name that's been given to this particular species is dragon's gold, which is strange as well. This is a plant that is actually in some parts of London is like a common garden shrub, and people will kind of might pop into a garden scene to be like, I'm looking for this dragon's gold tree, which is so strange to me, but not a wholly like negative feeling there. I think it's just that a realization that many, many other people have a completely different relationship to this tree. And also I learned that very similar looking species are like native to South America, particularly Chile. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting as well. Like this tree and ones that look similar, many people have different connections to it. So I think I wanted to convey that in some way as well.
I was wondering if we can get to another poem. This poem is on page 75 of Magnolia, and it's called April Kowhai. Mm. And this one is sort of, so I felt like it was almost the opposite of colonial conquest and grabbing the seeds after having murdered a few people and then taking them home and planting that in London soil. And what I love so much about this poem is like how this poem really puts the kowhai sort of in the tapestry of your life.
April kowhai. When the April heatwave came, my mum sent a WeChat video from Malaysia of an evening downpour. You can't see the rain, only the effects of it. A gasp from her mouth and a yellow flame tree reflected in the wet, shaking. I see a yellow blur from far away and walk closer, disbelieving. Here is a kowhai tree on the edge of a garden in North London in full bloom. For a moment, I do not breathe air. I breathe yellow. I breathe myself home. My phone is vibrating, telling me, you have a new memory. Here is a stream of pictures collected into an album, all taken somewhere far away. Home is not a place, but a string of colours threaded together and knotted at one end. Koanga, springtime, often synonymous with kōwhai, yellow. In another time and place, I watch the hills above the garden turn gold. When people say things like the hottest April day in 60 years, it becomes necessary to make note of the bright heat of the concrete, the fallen magnolias with their shy blood roots, the fingernail kōwhai blooms curling translucently like discarded chrysalids. Be still. You have a new memory. Ua kōwhai, light spring showers, or kōwhai showers, when the world becomes a sea of yellow. I now know it can happen anywhere, even somewhere cold. In her childhood bedroom, my mum slides back the mosquito net and holds her phone against the window pane, recording the rain.
Thank you. Yeah, you write so beautifully about this tree being so central to your concept of home. You know, when you come across it in North London, you write, "For a moment, I do not breathe air. I breathe yellow. I breathe myself home." God, I thought that was so beautiful. Has that shock worn off?
Well, still when I see one, I am very, very shocked and need to, like if I'm passing on a bus or in the car or something, I need to like make note of where it is so I can go back and check, like, is that really what I saw? There is one tree actually really close to where I live, like across the road and around the corner. And so I go look at it all the time. I don't know if the people who live in the house have noticed that I do that. But it's a really like a big mature tree as well, which is really interesting to me. So I think maybe the shock sometimes has worn off in the sense that there's one nearby, but I still regard it with wonder constantly. And in the first year that I was living where I live now, I would kind of go and check the progress of the flowering of the tree very often to kind of line it up with, in my brain, like, at what stage in spring will it kind of start to bloom? And I've learned that it's a very early spring. So that's changed my understanding of spring, I think, in the Northern Hemisphere.
Wait, can you tell more about that?
Sure. I think because I think spring here in London, I'm not sure about where you are, but it is very vibrant and very loud. And it's one of my favorite seasons, definitely here in London. And also in other places I've lived, like in Shanghai, it's also very green. But in New Zealand, or at least in Wellington, the seasons are not so delineated. And I kind of living there, I never necessarily had such a clear sense of seasons. There's not this idea of like falling leaves in autumn or boiling hot summer. It's just like Wellington's either very cold or like slightly less cold and always windy. So there's just always this wind. But then the kōwhai tree was the one of few markers of spring. Another one would be daffodils, which are also yellow and which we have here in London too, of course.
Yeah.
So I think that particular essay about the kōwhai tree, it's also an essay about spring and like learning a new language of spring, like in each place that I've lived, which I really enjoy doing.
Yeah, like you're recalibrating time or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, one thing that surprised me about your work is that, yes, you write about colonialism, you write about climate change. You know, like in this poem, for instance, when people say things like the hottest April in 60 years. So you're talking about all these very painful parts of our lives. You know, the fact that we live in the wake of colonialism, the fact that we live with the present and future threat of ecological collapse. But what was so surprising, I felt like in reading your work, is that the lead tone is pleasure.
physical pleasure, the colors, the scents, the sounds, the tastes. I don't know, as I was reading your poems, I just felt so much in my body, especially when you write about food. I felt like I was tasting your poems. Is that sort of how you live, sort of pleasure forward, you know?
I think I do try to, yeah. Particularly in this, in the sense of food and cooking, because on any given day, like what I'm going to cook or what I'm going to eat is like very tied up with my sense of self and like my mood. And I can't separate like what I'm eating or cooking from what I'm feeling. So that just comes out all the time in my writing. And I think you mentioned pleasure, and I think because poetry is very much about playfulness for me and playing with words and form, the shapes of words on the page. And so I think I get an inherent pleasure from that, and it brings me a lot of joy. So even sometimes, maybe even in writing about heavier things, the kind of the physical activity of making a poem is to me a pleasurable one. Yeah. And so I really, it gives me a lot of joy that you had that experience from the poems. Cause, yeah, I think that that is how I feel a lot of the time.
And when you talk about the physical pleasure of putting a poem together, is there any correlation between cooking and writing a poem, sort of physically, you know, is there anything that feels alike?
It is different. It is different, you know, but I remember maybe like in chemistry class in school, learning that cooking is chemical reaction, right? Like it cannot be reversed.
Yeah.
Like you're changing the state. And actually, I think that a poem, there's a physical change taking place. Something changing, like in the physical space between the book that you're holding or the screen you're reading a poem on and the reader. Mm-hmm. Some kind of exchange of energy. And I've definitely heard other poets speak about this, like maybe Ocean Vuong speaking about this exchange of energy. So I think it is connected. And I think when we think of cooking as a form of creativity and play, it doesn't always feel that way, of course. Sometimes it's just a chore, definitely for me as well. And sometimes like writing a poem, also sometimes too tired to write a poem, too tired to cook. But they are really connected. Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering if you wanted to read a poem, you know, food-centered poem. There were two that I was thinking about. One is Breakfast in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. And the other one is What We Talk About When We Talk About Home on page 67. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's another poem that you love. Like, what is a food poem that you're feeling most like reading?
Yeah, I think I love to read What We Talk About When We Talk About Home. What We Talk About When We Talk About Home. Lavender under the postbox, crushed seashells in the grass, peeling ginger in the sink, my hands feeling for the biggest, softest lemons, waiting here under the kofi. Scent of bai tai fried in ginger garlic, scent of crispy chicken rice wine steam. Breaths of sand and salt in January sun, carried on a southern gale force wind. To this place that always tastes the same, nothing broken, nothing blown away. Hello, hello, I can't quite hear you. Hello, oh, it's so strange to think it's not quite summer where you are.
I love this poem so much. At the end, that, I mean, that's how I interpreted this phone call home. There's always these technical issues. Hello, hello, I can't quite hear you. Yeah, the way that you encapsulate home in such a physical way, such a sensory way, it's just beautiful.
Mm, thank you.
Yeah. And when you were talking about cooking, you said it's a chemical reaction, you know, it can't be reversed. And I'm wondering if there's
a way in which you've made peace with your own physical state, your own lived life, which is also something that can't be reversed, obviously, right? That life where you would have been somewhere else and spoken different languages. Do you feel like you've come to a place of some acceptance about the constellation of sounds and smells and memories and limitations that you are?
I think I really have, although some days it can feel hard to tap into that acceptance or that kindness that I do really try to offer myself, particularly in times of homesickness, like the past couple of years, so many of us not being able to visit friends and family, right? So I think somewhere along the line, not sure when, but in the course of my writing, kind of realizing that home is a very broad word and can encompass so many things, and it's not one single place ever and will never be for me, I think. And acknowledging that that is a difficult thing, but that's also a gift as well. So carrying both of those feelings at the same time, I think I keep turning to poetry sometimes because there is that spaciousness for these conflicting emotions.
I was wondering if, you know, the fact that you always long a little bit for a place where you're not, have you accepted that as just sort of part of the sauce of who you are?
I think so. I mean, this is what I every week I'm talking to my therapist about, which helps. But so thank you for the reminder. No, but yeah, I guess this is just what I'm always coming back to in my writing, that longing.
Yeah.
The word longing, which can be like a very painful feeling, but other times maybe not painful, you know, maybe creative. It does get exhausting having that.
Yeah.
Having that always, but also knowing that it is such a shared experience. I think particularly here in London, which is like many big cities, is really full of people who are from somewhere else and have many homes and are here maybe temporarily, maybe not, but are kind of figuring out if this is a place where they can put roots down.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's definitely a community of people who are maybe not quite sure where we belong, but getting there. And so I really identify with that.
What are some of the ways in which you are trying to put roots down in London?
Yeah, it's hard to let yourself put roots down, I think, and let yourself to kind of settle, because then what does that mean? How does that change your relationship to other places where you have this connection, you know, this worry, does it weaken connections with other places? But I think it doesn't have to. And I noticed, because at the moment I'm actually moving house on Saturday, so doing like a lot of packing, but moving very close by, like a few streets away, but I'm just realizing that I've allowed myself to accumulate more stuff, like just as simple as books. Like I have a lot of especially poetry books, which is lovely, so I'm now letting myself collect things, and collecting things is something I love to do, but I wouldn't have kind of allowed myself to do that when I was a bit younger. So yeah, this maybe allowing myself to get attached to physical things or physical places.
Yeah, and it's good to hear that even though you're moving house, you're still quite close to the Ko-Fi tree around the corner.
Yeah, I am, yes, and close to my swimming spot, which was really important. Those things really anchor me.
Thank you.
Nina Minya Powell's debut poetry collection is titled Magnolia. It was a finalist for the 2021 Ondaatje Prize and a finalist for the 2020 Forward Prize for Best First Collection. She also wrote an essay collection titled Small Bodies of Water and a diary through food titled Tiny Moons, A Year of Eating in Shanghai. To find out more about her writing, her zines, and other craft projects, check out her website, ninapowles.com. That's Nina and then P-O-W-L-E-S. Or you can check out the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikkefoes and Erik van der Westen. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.